Welcome to Screw the Clout. I'm your host, Steve Stanulis. Each week, we're going to have amazing guests share their stories of saying, screw it. Tune in each week. This is Screw the Clout.
Welcome to another episode of Screw the Clout. My name is Steve Stanulis, and we have a really, really interesting guest today. I'm very excited. We have Mr. Eric O'Day on, who I actually, like most of my guests, have some sort of relationship with over the years. He just finished a book, which I'm so excited to read, but it's called 3 Years in Pakistan. So, Eric, welcome to the show.
I really appreciate you having me on the show. I finally completed my book. It's called 3 Years in Pakistan, the Eric O'Day story. It took me forever to write it because I kept trying to, it took me exactly 2 years to write it, 7 years to edit it. And it wasn't because I was procrastinating or anything. It's just because I would have a bunch of ghostwriters come in and want to write my book, but I would spend 3-4 months with them telling them my story. And they would try to go get an advance from a publishing house. You know, they were looking for like $150,000, $250,000 just to write my book. No one was willing to give that kind of money. So they lose interest. I'd waste all that time. And then time would go by and I would do it again and again and again. And finally, I just had enough. I kind of got dejected and just sort of sat on it, went on with my life. I was doing a movie in Utah with Code of Honor, terrible Seagal movie. But I was doubling the lead on the movie, a guy named Craig Schaefer.
He played. Before you go any further, is there anything other than terrible Steven Seagal movies these days?
I mean, no, they're down there. Already there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Steven Seagal. I mean, the other reason you'd watch it is if you wanted to play a drinking game and just be like, oh, some crap that you know that Steven Seagal just wrote himself and put on a cue card behind the camera. He doesn't read the script. He doesn't do the lines that are in there. He just does his own stuff and does whatever he wants. When I was a kid, I mean, I'd watch Van Damme, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, and Seagal movies and be like, yeah, these guys are awesome. I'll tell you right now, after working with Seagal, even in his heyday, I don't care how good of a fighter he is, I would wreck that dude. I would wreck him, all right? I would maul him like a bear. Okay? Everything that dude does, he does this. All right, try to hit me. I'm on set with this guy, just a quick story. I'm on set with this guy, and I'm doubling the lead, Craig Schaefer, who was the quarterback in the movie, the program. And Seagal's just beating the crap out of beating the crap out of me. And the director's like, well, Craig's the lead. He has to fight back. So Seagal's like, fine, whatever. Try to hit me. I said, you want me to come across? And he's like, just listen to the words coming out of my mouth. Just try to hit me. So I jabbed down and I cracked him across his chin, right? And this, I mean, I caught him. Trust me. If I stood just another 6 inches close and put my shoulder into it, I would have laid him out. He was like, put the lid on the other guy. And this other guy was like a 56-year-old dude who was there for like the knife fighting. And he proceeds to just beat the shit out of that dude, right?
That's great. That's
he was
great.
A piece of shit. It was hysterical. Seagal, if you ever watch this, you're a piece of shit, dude. Absolute piece of shit.
Well, yeah, again, I don't want to get off the topic. All right. But he used to live in Staten Island with Kelly LeBrock when he was in his heyday. And my brother used to, do security. He used to have all the cops work for him. And you know, there was not too many fans of his after they worked with him. I'll say that.
Yeah, his own bodyguard was talking crazy shit about him on set. And I was like, aren't you supposed to protect him? And the guy was like, I think from Bulgaria or Budapest. And he was like, you ever hear the saying, the honeymoon's over?
That's great.
The reason why I bring this up is because I'm doubling the actor Craig Schaefer on this movie. And I'm working on this movie, I think it was like 6 weeks. We're stuck in Salt Lake City. Cabin fever on the weekends. I go to a restaurant. Craig and I go and have dinner. And we're talking about just life and whatever else. And Craig goes, I know who you are. I wasn't telling any of my story or anything. He had just, I guess he had seen a Locked Up Abroad episode and seen me. And then just everything just it hit, you know. In the industry, you see people you recognize and you're like, oh, I must have seen him on something. You can't quite pin it. Well, he finally pinned it. And then he started asking me all these questions about my life and my story. He's like, holy crap, why hasn't a book been written about that? I tell him about all the ghostwriters that would just wasted my time and couldn't get any money and time had gone by. He's like, well, why don't you write it? And I never had confidence whatsoever in writing my own book. I never had any confidence. But Craig, I thank God I met Craig. And I thank God we became friends because Craig was adamant about me writing my own book. He's like, just write one chapter. Just write one chapter. So I wrote a chapter. I sent it to him. He's like, this is great. Keep going. And maybe he'd give me a note or two. But he was like, the inspiration and actually getting the fire lit under me to do this myself. So over the course of 2 years, I would write and send them and write and send them and write and send them. And so if it wasn't for Craig, I never would have written my book. After I finally wrote my book, I just put everything on paper because I'm not a writer. I don't know how to do it the right way in chapters and everything. It was just one long story. That's all it was, and tangents of me going left and right and telling my story. So I would try to get editors, and editors would come out of the woodwork, like especially like on Twitter or Instagram, saying, "I'll edit your book. This is what I do." And then I would say, "Look, I want you to edit it the way I want, so that you're not cutting out my sense of humor, my personality, or you know, my taste." And these guys, it was like they took a machete to a rainforest and just started ripping away at everything. And the story started to read like radio instructions, or just like, you know, it wasn't. There was no character there. There was no personality. There was no love. There was, you know, no humor. And I would get another editor, and they would do the same thing. Take my money and run, take my money and run. So 7 years go by, and I can't find an editor to do it the way I want it to be done, or they want a lot of money. Finally, a buddy of mine, Alex Ford, a guy I've known since I was a teenager. He's a writer. He's not an editor, but he's a writer. He writes scripts, and he gets my sense of humor. He knows my story. He's like, "Look, Eric, I'll take a stab at it." So we started doing it together, and he was doing it the way I wanted, and he was doing great. And we went through it together, and we finally cranked it out. It took we started this in late last year, and he finished it. And I was very happy with the way it turned out. Honestly, it's my story, good and bad. It's not, I mean, it's not glamorous. People who know me are going to read it and be like, "Wow, I had no idea this is how it was." Everyone assumes it's just what happened in Pakistan, but it's not. It's my whole life from basically, I wrote it as linear as I could, but there was times I would forget things and I'd have to go back to it because, you know, your memories don't come flying back at you all at once, you know, like all of a sudden you're thinking of something. So I would move on and just write what I can remember. And then out of nowhere, something would come back to me. I went, "Oh," and I'd go back and write. I start when I was a kid. And the reason why I start as a kid is because I had a terrible childhood. You know, I'll say this, if anyone was built for prison, it was me. And the reason why I was built for prison was because of everything I'd go through from a kid on up to an adult. I was run over by a school bus when I was 8 years old. I was told I'd never walk again. I had my urethra severed. I had a colostomy bag. I had a catheter. I was told I'd never be normal again. I would have 52 surgeries between my age of 8 to 15 years old. So I knew what pain was. And people see me today and they go, "He doesn't look like he got run over by a bus." It's because I was so young and healing and growing. That's why I was able to do it. I feel pain to this day because of the bus accident, but it doesn't show. I was told that I would never be a normal kid. I ended up becoming a football superstar, basically. I played for a very small high school, so it wasn't fair that I played, but I always knew where the play was going ahead of time because of learning how to read the line. Someone on that line was always giving the play away. I had a terrible childhood. I grew up with a very smothering, abusive mother. I delve onto that. I'm the youngest of 6 boys, but I'm the only one to grow up with my mother. So that should kind of tell you what kind of person she was. You know, I dealt with a lot of abuse. I dealt with a lot of what people today would think is just a bad life. But for me, it was my life. And I learned to adjust. I learned to cope. I went through a lot of bad things. A lot of bad things happening to me in my life, and I just learned to get through it. You know, that's what my book is about. So it takes a bit to get into the Pakistan version, but once you get up to Pakistan, you start to understand how I'm able to cope and deal and adjust to everything that's happening to me in Pakistan because of everything I had to adjust to and learn and go through as a child.
It's always good, obviously, to show the person you were and how you got to where you are and how things, you know, everything that happens in your life leads to another thing. So obviously, if you didn't have that childhood and that tough life, like you said, you probably wouldn't have been able to survive.
I don't think I would have. I think that the tough life that I went through was God's way of preparing me for everything that I was going to have to go through one day.
God gives us what we can handle, right? So you're in Pakistan, right? How the fuck did you end up in Pakistan?
When I was 19, I was a nighttime manager at a gym in Burbank called World Gym, and I was also a personal trainer, and I was training people there to how to work out on the machines and how to get in shape and, you know, motivate them to do the exercises. And one of my clients was a very successful Armenian businessman who told us his name was Ray Gazarian. And I would work out with him 3-4 times a week. And we became friends over the course of a year. And he was hiring people. He had several companies, but one of his businesses was a leather business where he would have people in their late teens, early 20s travel around the world for him, importing expensive leather samples and getting paid for it. Now, supposedly, I'm just giving you the crackerjack version of it, but each leather piece was anywhere from $1,500, $3,000, very fine, expensive clothing. And by having somebody go over to, it wasn't to Pakistan, first of all, the trips were originally to Turkey. By having someone go over to Turkey and have a free vacation, come back through another country, whether it be Sweden, Paris, Italy, you get a free trip, you get $800 spending cash. All you have to do is claim that the clothing is yours to beat the 55% import tax. And supposedly we're bringing back $25,000, $30,000 worth of leather goods. So by sending someone like you or me over there, giving them a free trip, giving them $800 spending money, he was saving $14,000, $16,000 per trip by beating the import tax. The trip obviously was too good to be true. I would be the one who found out the hard way that we were all being used to unknowingly smuggle narcotics. And it was on my third trip, which wasn't even supposed to be mine. It was supposed to be my brother's. Over the course of the next few years, I would, before I found out what it was that we were being used to really do, I thought it was a dream situation. I thought the job was a right place, right time. To get paid to travel to other countries was a dream come true. For me, the trips were the payment. I'd never been out of the country before. I got this job, and I wanted to keep these opportunities open. So I'd encourage it to my friends, my family, my brothers, my mother. I thought it was, and people went on these trips because of my recommendation. And a lot of other people at the gym, I would see them go on trips. They're the ones who talked me into it because they were going, they were having good times. They had good stories. I didn't go until a girl I was dating at the time broke up with me. It was over the holidays, and you know, that's a bad combination. Holidays alone, you know, when you get depressed, and a girl broke up with me, and my buddy who was offering these trips noticed that I was obviously a little down and says, you know what, you need to go on a trip for me. And literally a week later, I was on my first trip to Turkey, and I had a great time. I felt like the world wasn't as big anymore. It was kind of smaller, but in a good way. And he wanted, you know, when I got back, everything went the way he said it was. You know, as his contacts contacted me, I had a manifest to like grade all the leather goods. And it was easy. It was cool. He wanted me to go the next month. I couldn't because I was filming. I was working. You know, I was a working actor. I was a working stuntman. But I wanted to keep these opportunities open. So like I said, I was encouraging them to other people, other, you know, friends. And people were making these trips because of me. You know, when something good happens to me, I try to share it with everyone else. And I went on a trip again the following year, and then 9/11 happens, and no one wants to go on any trips, understandably. Absolutely right. Understandable. I'm no longer working at the gym anymore because I'm working as a stuntman. I'm filming the movie Scorpion King over the course of a year and a half. I just worked all like 6 months on the movie Planet of the Apes with Mark Wahlberg. I'm reoccurring in 4 different TV shows. I'm auditioning all the time. So I'm a working stuntman. I'm a working actor, and I'm paying all my bills this way. Like, I'm living the dream. My brother, Peter, he says, hey, Eric, I could really use the $800. He was in a bad spot in his life at that time. And so I set him up with my friend, Ray. I'm literally filming the show, the Andy Dick Show, this week. And I got a pilot later on that month and another movie I got things lined up. I got everything going for me, everything great going for me in my life. And Ray calls me and says, hey, your brother says he's not going, man. I've already set everything up. You need to talk to him. And I don't understand this because, yeah, my brother was excited. And so I call my brother and go, Peter, what's going on? He says, yeah, I'm not going. Just like matter of fact, I'm like, okay, why? Yeah, it's not safe over there. Peter, Turkey's a safe country. I've gone there twice. You're going to love it. He goes, it's not to Turkey. It's to Pakistan. And this is the first I was hearing is to Pakistan. Is this through my brother, Peter? I can't vouch for Pakistan. I can only vouch for Turkey. So I call Ray to say, hey, what is this that Peter's talking about? And he's like, yeah, well, I'm getting a really good deal because of what's going on in Afghanistan. Because remember, this is just a couple months after 9/11. This is like late January after 9/11. So I said, well, if you're getting such a good deal, then just FedEx everything back. You know, he's like, look, Eric, all right, your brother has to go. I've set up. I'm going to lose a lot of money. He started to give me a guilt trip. And by this time, Ray was a good friend of mine. I considered him a good friend. We'd hang out. We'd grab coffee. You know, in a sense, I wanted to be like him because he was successful. He had a bunch of cool things going on. And he sort of he guilt tripped me. And he's a great used car salesman. My brother, I knew wasn't going to go. And I didn't want my brother to go. But I didn't want to let Ray down. So I took the trip in my brother's place. And I always say this, I'm glad it was me who found out the hard way what it was we were all being used to do, because it was all a smokescreen. By keeping our attention off of, we thought beating the import tax is a big deal. And turns out by us keeping our attention on that, we weren't thinking about what we were really being used to do. Also, they don't have to pay us what we were worth, because, you know, normal drug smugglers are getting paid anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000. By paying someone, like having an idiot like me go over, they figure I won't draw suspicion to myself because I don't know I'm being used to smuggle narcotics, and they don't have to pay me what I'm worth. I would never have done it if I had known that it was narcotics related. Obviously, I would never have done it. Like I said, I had everything going for me. I had everything to lose and nothing to gain. I wasn't a user. I was a gym rat. I had a great life before all this happened. So for this to happen to me, I'm glad it happened to me, but it was messed up because I was not part of this in any way, shape, or form. And I had a great life before this all happened.
So you go, again, you're oblivious, obviously. You go to Pakistan, and what happens?
I go to Pakistan right away. As soon as I land in Pakistan, I'm the only white guy to get off the plane. Everyone is dressed in burqas, and girls look like goalies. You know, it's dirty there. There's lots and lots of people, but there's no foreigners there. Like, you don't see any foreigners. It's just me, and everyone is staring at me, not with pleasant eyes either, like with daggers. No one likes us, like, whatsoever. I'm like, this sucks. Ray's contacts meet me at the airport, and they tell me Ray messed up, that I was supposed to fly to Karachi. And that I was like, okay. They're like, so they're just going to throw me at a hotel and then drive to Karachi and be back in 5 days. I'm like, no, that's not what Ray said. Ray told me that these guys were going to, like, show me around. We were going to have a great time. We're going to love it. Everything was going south fast. And I was also told that these guys were going to give me some spending money there in Pakistan. So when I told them, they probably like the dirtiest, darkest hotel. There was nothing to see sightseeing wise. And when I told them that Ray says you guys are going to give me like a couple $100 to spend, they're like, oh, he did, huh? They gave me 1,000 rupees. That was like $17. And I went through it almost the first day. I would end up drinking some water the first day at some hole in the wall restaurant, which was a terrible idea. But this, you know, I'm a kid. I don't know any better. I'm an idiot. 100%. I agree. I was an absolute idiot. But I drank some water. I got sick. I got like the deli belly. I was sick all the way to Thursday. I just stayed in my hotel room and just watched. They had HBO there with commercials on it, and I was watching like Citizen Kane and all these old movies from the 80s. And I just couldn't. I was counting the seconds until I can get out of there. Friday morning comes. I'm feeling better. I started to feel better the day before Thursday. I was drinking like 7-Up and Coke that I ordered on room service. And Friday morning comes, and I have an early morning flight. And I can't wait to get out of this damn country. And only one of the guys shows up. Not the two guys at the airport, but one of them shows up, and they want me to come downstairs. I'm like, no, I was told you guys got to come upstairs. I got to go through everything, make sure it's good. And they bring just one suitcase. This is not at all how it would go in Turkey. Turkey, I'd have two suitcases that like weighed my shoulders down. They were so heavy. And I end up having to pay extra at the airports because they were so heavy for the weight. This was just one suitcase. It had 7 pieces in it, and it was light. It wasn't heavy at all. And this didn't make sense. So I call Ray from the hotel, and granted, he picks up. He goes, oh, because it's a first trip, it's, you know, it's fine. It's supposed to be light. Like, he always had an answer for everything. And instead of this like a huge red flag for me, I'm thinking, all right, cool. Now I don't have to pay extra money for the weight at the airport. So I'm happy now. It doesn't weigh as much. On the way to the airport, this guy's like, next time you come back, we'll hang with you. We'll show you around. We'll introduce you to a bunch of girls. I'm humoring him. I'm like, sure, yeah, next time. I knew for a fact I was never coming back to Pakistan. I get out of the car. Dude gives me a hug, and I'm walking to the international departure, and I'm the tallest guy there by like 6 inches. And there's this long line. As soon as I round the corner, customs officer at the front waves me to the front. I'm like, awesome. I get to go all the way to the front. You know, I'm thinking it pays to be an American. And they go through my stuff. Everything's fine. I'm about to go through the metal detector, and someone else grabs my arm, and he looks at me and he goes, you carrying narcotics? And I said, check it again. they take not my stuff. I had a backpack and another bag, but they take the suitcase and they throw all the jackets on the floor and then take off with the suitcase to another room. I'm like, I'm pissed now because I'm there for the jackets, right? So that's, you know, I feel like this is fucking disrespectful. So I'm folding up, cleaning everything because that's what I'm there for. And they take me to another room. Some time's going by and I don't want to miss my flight. So I said, I don't care what you guys do with the suitcase. Get me another suitcase or another bag so I can at least carry all my clothing. Guards start to fill up out in the hallway. And I, you know, I'm just worried I'm going to miss my damn flight. And the guy who grabbed my arm comes back with another guard behind him who's holding, like, he's holding, I keep saying it's like two newspapers because they were really thin, like a brownish green. And he goes, what is this? And I'm like, he's holding it, you know, meaning like he should know, he's the one holding it. And then he looks at me and goes, this is all film. And as soon as he says that, trust me, 2 + 2 became 4 so fast. But I said, why are you showing me this? And he says, this came out of your luggage. And I was like, motherfuck. Like, I didn't think these guys were trying to set me up at all. No, I wasn't like, they're trying to set me up. No, I knew, it's like, fucking Ray. This is like literally what I was thinking. I was like, fucking Ray. And so I said something you never want to say when you're on vacation. I said, need to speak with the American embassy. And the guy says to me, he's like this fucking tall. He gets in my face and goes, embassy can't help you. We're going to hang you after 5 o'clock prayer. Holy shit. Now I freak out, dude. I freak out when this guy does that. I'm like, oh, crap. That day they said I tried to escape. I wasn't trying to escape because I didn't know where the fuck to go. Only thing I was trying to do that day was find a phone. I would end up finding a phone. And I was barricaded down the hallway in front of in someone's office that had like a waiting room area, and there was no windows, but I put all the furniture and the desk and the filing cabinets. And I was trying to call out, I was trying to call my manager, Richard Castleberry. He always says, if you're in trouble, you call me first. So I'm trying to call him because he knew what I was doing. And I knew that if I can call him, he would warn everyone else. I was trying to call my mother. Hell, I was trying to call 911. I couldn't get out because of the language barrier. And I was pushing button 00, whatnot. Finally, sometime later, I hear an American voice on the other side of the door, and he says, you want to speak to an American? I'm like, are you from the embassy? He says, DEA. I tell him, they said they're going to hang me. He speaks to someone over there in a different language, and he goes, they were kidding, through the door. Now, I don't think you should kid about shit like that. Trust me, I wish I knew that was a joke. It made me look really bad. I hurt a lot of guys. I freaked out. Yeah, it looked bad because I've been striking everyone through it. Some asshole shot up the whole hallway. So the DEA... he's like, you don't have to talk to us. I'm like, yes, I want to talk to you guys. But the DEA, a bunch of cocksuckers, I'll tell you right now, they, because in their eyes, you're guilty. If you're drugs related, you're guilty. They don't care if you're innocent. They want to know who you're buying it from and who your suppliers are and all this bullshit. So they take me to another part of the airport, which is like another office. And then all the guards are like holding onto my arms. And like people are putting their finger on me to feel like they're helping move me across the airport. And they bring me to this office that is someone else's office, and then they're all waiting outside. Now, 3 DEA agents just start bombarding me with all these questions. And while I'm halfway through one answer, this guy's asked me a question. I try to answer that question. And this guy's asking a question. They were just trying to see if my words were going to change or my story was going to change. And they didn't believe a word I said. And finally, I started realizing these guys were being cocksuckers because one guy was like, how long have you been using? You a junkie? And I'm like, look at me, dude. I was at the time, I was a gym rat. It was like 225 pounds. Benching 420, you know, I would go to the gym and I was dipping with 120 pound between my weights. I mean, this is all I did. It was acting, working out, eating right, and just I wanted to be an action hero, and I was a stuntman. So these guys weren't believing a word out of my fucking mouth. All right, and I realized that right away. I said, you know what? Just give me the benefit of the doubt. Other people are making these trips. You gotta warn them. And like, well, we're gonna, you know, look into your information. And so they started calling me an asshole and saying I'm being a punk and that this country's going to, you know, show me how weak I am. I wasn't having it because I was scared, but I was mad. I was pissed because I shouldn't have been in this fucking situation. And these guys weren't believing me. So I'm like, call my mom, talk to them, you know, go get Ray. You're going to find out and warn everyone else that are making these fucking trips. They told me that their last words to the Pakistanis is, he's all yours, you know? Like all that, it's more detailed in my book, what happened, because it was actually worse than that. For the next 3 days, I'd be tortured for information I did not have. I was asked, you know, I was electrocuted. I was punched like a punching bag. I had the bottom of my feet beaten. I was drowned. And on the third day, they just wanted me to admit the drugs were mine. I never admitted anything at all. Like I said, if anyone was built for jail, it was me. The pain that was coming my way was nothing compared to the pain I dealt with as a kid from the bus accidents or growing up. The drowning was crazy because the previous year the show Fear Factor had just come out, and the guy who won the first episode was some out of shape bartender who held his breath for a minute and 13 seconds, and he won $50,000. So after watching that episode, I was like, I'm going to get on the show and I'm going to win. And I would practice holding my breath. I would practice holding my breath when I was at a stoplight, in the shower, before I went to bed. And I got it to where I could comfortably hold my breath almost 3 minutes. And I only started doing that, I think it was like the October or November before I was arrested. Like, what are the odds of that? It was nuts. And so here I am being drowned for information I don't have. And they were holding me under a minute every time. And I would act like it was really tough, but it wasn't. And I'm thinking to myself, holy crap, what are the odds that I prepared for this shit just a couple months ago? Well, when I finally got sent to the biggest prison in all of Pakistan, once again, I'm the only American that's been arrested in this country at this time. And I don't know since then, but at this time, I'm the only American in this country. They sent me to the biggest prison in Pakistan, a prison meant to house only 1,800 people, but it's overcrowded. There's over 6,000 prisoners there, hundreds coming and going every day. And there's this welcoming committee there, and these guys called number darts. Number darts are prisoners who get extra privileges for doing the guard's dirty work. And one of the privileges they get is they get to shake down all the new prisoners that come in the prison. And the shakedowns are they start slapping you and hitting you, and they're looking for like watches and money and anything of value, nice jackets, nice sandals. And normally there'd be like one number dart to one prisoner, two number darts to one prisoner, you know, because there was like usually like a dozen prisoners going in at once. And these guys would always just like cower and everything else. I don't know any of this at the time, but when I get there, I'm pissed. I'm thinking I'm only going to be here for a day, two at max. I'm thinking Oz, the TV show Oz that I used to watch back home on HBO, and how if you're like weak, you're going to be somebody's bitch. I know that so many people back home know that I'm innocent. So I'm thinking like my mom's on the phone trying to get people out there. They're going to find a real raid. The embassy's going to come and get me out of jail. Naively, I'm thinking I'm only going to be here a day, couple days max. So instead of going in, you know, nice and friendly and shaking hands, I'm thinking, fuck this, it's opening, kick off, the guard's over here, he's getting ready for a fight. I'm like, just open the fucking door. And my whole goal was not to let these guys surround me. My goal was to go through them and then turn it more into like a one-on-one, two-on-one as I'm backpedaling. Great thing about Pakistanis are they have long beards, they have dresses, and they have sandals. I'm going in with like, you know, my jacket, my combat boots, and you know, I'm just stacked on these guys. So I'm using their beards against them, throwing them into the ground. I'm just dropping these guys as they keep backpedaling. And the guards are probably loving it because they were just watching this whole mayhem at the front of the prison. Like everyone knew I had entered the prison. After I dropped all these guys and everyone was still like trying to like, what do? Do we continue? Or it was a little Mashakti. Mashakti is a prison worker who comes over. He's like 4'10", 4'11". He's like, la, 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 la. And I'm thinking like, he's not going to attack me because he's too small or he's suicidal. And he grabs my wrist to like follow him. So he's like basically telling these guys to fuck off and me to follow him. I'm being led throughout those enormous prison. I mean, the whole prison, there's a world inside this prison, and it's all open skies and everything else. There's a fountain at the front. There's big pomegranate trees everywhere. Like I get led to the processing barrack, and in the processing barrack, it was empty at the time. I'm just trying to sleep and whatever. I'm just because I'm tired. But it's daytime too. It's not nighttime. Still, it's daytime. And you know how you can tell if someone's in your bubble? I hear like feet scampering in and everything. So I literally open my eyes. And the second I open my eyes, it's like everyone's right there. I'm like, oh, Jesus. And one guy's like, what country? And I learned this the hard way. You don't ever say America. So I was like, Pakistan, born and raised. Been here my whole life. You know, and they're like, no, America. And then on the front of the paper is this dickhead from America with his arms around the guards when I got arrested. And they took all these photos. And I'm like, that doesn't even look like me. And then next thing I know, I'm fighting all these assholes, except I'm losing. They end up dragging me to Kasauri, okay? And they drag me, but I walk, you know, and they're like holding me and hitting me and all this stuff. They take me to Kasauri. Kasauri's punishment cell in prison. It's the size of a closet. It's pitch black. You can't even see your hand in front of your face. It's so dark. You only get fed once a day in there. And the food you get fed is lentil soup, like dal, and a roti. Just once a day. There's a hole in the corner where you use the restroom. There's no running water whatsoever. And the only time you see sunlight is when they beat the bottom of your feet. They bring you up and beat the bottom of your feet. I would spend the first 5 days in that room that I was in jail. I would end up spending a total of 132 days over the course of 3 years in that room. The longest I spent in that room in a row was 8 weeks in a row.
So that's got to fucking fuck you up mentally. I mean,
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, well, first of all, you're in his room, right? It's a seismic closet. You're getting fed once. You're getting your feet beaten. What's going through your mind? Do you ever say, this is it, I'm done here?
I never thought, look, at this point, I'm thinking like, because like, I know I'm innocent and I know other people know I'm innocent. It's not just me. It's not just me and no one ever knows. No, it's a terrible situation, but there are so many factors happening that I'm like, there's no way they're going to leave me here, because the asshole wasn't just hiring me. He was hiring everybody. He was, you know, so I know that people back home are trying to do something. And this doesn't happen to innocent people. That's what I'm thinking. This doesn't happen to innocent people. So at no point I'm like, oh no, I'm going to die. I'm like, fuck this, man. This ain't happening. I'm going to be out of here soon. I thought at the most I was going to be there a couple days. The embassy comes and visits me. They bring me out of consortium on the first day. And that's when I learned you're going to go back to court in 2 weeks. I'm like, what? That's when it started to become real. For my safety, they couldn't put me in general population. So he decided to put me on death row, which is where you're supposed to be if you're a convict. But that's the safest place they can be. So they gave me a cell on death row, and I would spend the first 9.5 months in jail on death row. That superintendent got swapped out with a different superintendent. Then the new superintendent came in and was like, why is he on death row? Is he convicted? They're like, no, he's not. He's under trial. He's like, all right, well, no, he shouldn't be on death row. Let's put him in the foreigner's barracks. And like, you can't put him in the barracks because people keep trying to kill him. So they're like, all right, we'll put him in two cells for like the political prisoners or the prisoners who have money. And thank God, that's the one thing I thank God I was an American, because if they put me in the fucking barracks, I probably would have been killed, raped, all that fun stuff. You know, I like to think, oh, I'm going to take on everyone. But man, you can only do so much. And, you know, they put me in two cell. I get my own cell, which is a luxury in Pakistan. No one else had their own cell. No one. Normally cells would have three in these rooms, in the political prisoner rooms. They would have a minimum three, but sometimes up to nine. And there's no beds. It's just one squat toilet. So you would have guys head to foot, just praying all day and laying there like sardines. I would go back to court so many times. It was a waste of time. Pakistan is a very corrupt country. And if you're a drug smuggler or an actual criminal, you want to get caught in a country like Pakistan, because then you can work the system to your favor. You can pay off the judge. You can pay off the prosecutor. You can pay off the witnesses. You can pay off the cops. And they'll say, oh, he wasn't caught with 5 kg of heroin. He was caught with only a couple hundred grams of heroin. And it now goes from a big punishment to a little punishment. There would be prisoners who knew how to work this game, and they would get arrested again and again. Many prisoners had come back to Pakistan while I was there. There was one particular prisoner, this South African kid, tall white kid. He was like 6'8", 6'9". He had a very deep voice, and he loved Tupac, so he had everyone call him Tupac. And he came to prison 30 times while I was there. And if you're innocent and you fight it, you're going to be punished. But if you're guilty, you just work the game, you pay the judge off, pay the prosecutor off, plead guilty, you get a small sentence, and you go home. Because I was innocent and I refused to plead guilty for a crime I didn't commit, I'd be punished. I'd be sentenced to 7 years, which I was thankful for. I thought I was going to get life in prison or death. I was given 7 years, but the whole time I was in prison, I didn't just sit in a corner and feel sorry for myself. I was learning the language. I was learning the law. I was practicing the law. I became a lawyer in Pakistan, and I helped get seven other foreigners out. But I also learned the law that I'll be able to get myself out. The first year sucked in jail. Absolutely sucked. The second 2 years, though, I became the OG in the prison. I became like Red from Shawshank Redemption. If you needed something, you came to me. If you needed a cell phone, if you needed VCDs, if you wanted a smoothie or something like that, smoothie machine, you wanted ice, you came to me. I didn't deal with women, alcohol, or drugs, or weapons. I dealt with things that would help your mind go by: books, magazines, cell phones, games. You know, in a sink or swim situation, I was jet skiing, and it was because of everything I learned as a kid.
What is the light at the end of the tunnel when you finally get to the point where you know you're getting out, or what's the turning point there?
Nothing was easy. I had to go through one of the worst beatings. The turning point in jail was I took a beating so bad from one of the guards and all the other guards, but under this one particular guard's directions. I had all the fingers on my right hand broken. I had a couple ribs broken. I just beat the shit out of it. All I could do was cover up and think to myself, let it in. I thought I was going to be killed that day. But I took a beating long enough that, and I kept the guards out of my room just long enough to get the attention of the new superintendent, who never left his cell or his office. He didn't come into the prison unless it was a search day. But he noticed all the guards had left their stations. So he decided, like, what the fuck is going on in the prison? And he came into the prison, saw me just getting stomped on, and starts demanding to know what's happening. And the one guard who was ordering all this, he was, you know, he wanted money from me. I told him to fuck himself. And that's what led to this whole altercation. He tells the superintendent that he found drugs on me, that I attacked him. And by this time I had learned the language. I had been teaching myself the language, like 20 to 40 words every day. So they didn't know that I was speaking the language and understanding it. And I'm on the floor just jacked up telling the superintendent that he's lying, that they wanted money from me. I told him to fuck off and that they're stealing money from me. I'm starving to death. I'm going to die. And he comes over and he's like, "You speak Urdu?" I'm like, "Yes, sir." And he's like, "What happened?" I tell him this guy wanted money from me. I told him to go to hell. And he's like, "I believe you." And he fired that guard right there on the spot. That one particular guard was a monster for everyone in the prison, absolutely everyone in the prison. And he asked me, "Who else has been messing with you?" And I pulled 7 more guards out of that crowd by their name tags, which were in Urdu. And that day, 7 guards got, 6 more guards, 7 guards got fired, but not just the 7, the one. That one who was a monster for everyone, him being kicked out of the prison and never to be allowed to return was a huge turning point. Because now these prisoners who hated my guts were like, "Hey, thank you. Appreciate it. You need anything, you let me know." When I woke up in the hospital the next day, there were like sweet dishes, Cokes, chicken, cards. The whole prison was sending me like thank yous for getting rid of a monster that was just making life hell for everyone. And after that was the biggest turning point in jail. Like, people weren't trying to attack me all the time. People were appreciative of me. The guards weren't always trying. The guards weren't coming into my. They never came into my cell again after that, trying to get money out of me or beat me while I was sleeping. And by this time, when I had learned the language enough, that people started to see me as a human being, and I started to see them as human beings. And you know, my best weapon in jail was learning the language, so that people can communicate with me.
You talk about turning a negative into a positive. I mean, the fact that you didn't say, "I'm going to die here," you held strong, you learned the language. All these things in hindsight was what kept you alive and probably why we're talking today. So let's go to the point where the day you get out.
December 23rd, 2004, Pakistan's a day ahead. So my flight was out of Pakistan on Christmas Day because I was the only white guy on the flight. When I landed in Chicago, I was the only one white guy there. They're like, "Hey, what the hell?" Like, they weren't searching anyone. They were being really lax because of the holiday. But I got pulled out of the crowd, and there was all these empty rows of customs agents in Chicago O'Hare. And one guy was looking at the computer, and all of a sudden he looks up at me, looks down at the computer, goes and gets someone behind him. The other person walks over, and they're looking at the computer, and they look at me. And then every single customs official, there may be 15 plus, were all gathered behind the computer. I don't know what was on that computer because the screen was away from me. It must have been interesting because everyone was watching that. And then they end up strip searching me in Chicago. They were looking for drugs, clearly. I missed my connecting flight to LAX, but I didn't care. I was back home. I was back in America. So I would end up getting back in LAX and December 26th. There was a lot of media interest and attention on my story, but if I had gotten home on the 25th, obviously there would have been more, maybe more interest. But because I got home on the 26th, 300,000 people died that day from the Southeast Asia tsunamis, and so that put my story to the back by far. And that all happened on Christmas Day. My first week back, I tried staying at my mom's, but she thought that I was 24 years old when I got back, and my mom thought that I was going to be a kid again. And she's, you know, everyone figured I was messed up, you know, from prison. Everyone thought that I was going to be suffering from PTSD. I just wanted to get my life back together.
What happens to the guy that set you up?
He was never punished for what he did to me, but he signed a confession that he set me up. I sued him. I successfully sued him. I sued him for in 2007 and was awarded $20.4 million judgment against him. I've never collected. Every 10 years, I have to renew that judgment against him, which is compounding 10% interest. So it's double that now. So the guy probably owes me over $50 million now, which obviously, unless he wins the lottery or strikes it big with crypto, regardless, I will keep renewing that. I'll keep renewing that judgment against him. But he was never punished for what he did.
Did you ever confront him face to face?
Yeah. No, I found him. I found him I found him in 2011 on Facebook. I found him in Facebook in 2011. I was able to get him to come to a place in Northridge. And my goal was to just find out where he lived because of the judgment. You know, I wanted to find out where he lived, but my plan didn't go that way. I ended up beating the shit out of him in a parking lot at a Ralph's. And well, kind of, sort of. Everyone, all they saw was a big white guy beating the crap out of an Armenian. So it looked like a hate crime. The cops were called. I left before they understood what was going on, you know. And then a month later, a detective contacted me, asked him to come to the station in Devonshire, in Northridge, to clear my name. And I was like, I don't think that's how it works. You know, maybe when I was a kid, I'd believe that, but I learned a lot since then. And I was like, so you guys are calling people now to clear their name? That's nice of you. I mean, the guy's like, well, bottom line, if you don't come to us, we'll come to you. And I was like, come to me. I'm not going to make this arrest easy. I called a poker buddy of mine who was an entertainment attorney. He put me in touch with another attorney who got the story for me. And bottom line says, well, what did you say to the cops? I basically told them to go fuck themselves. And he's like, well, that's the only good news I've heard. So he was glad I didn't talk to the cops, but he contacted the police on my behalf and said, and basically this is the story, is the guy I beat up went to the cops and told them that some crazy white guy claims I put him on death row. I don't know who he is. I've never met him before. And that's where he went wrong. And my lawyer was like, well, my client has a civil suit judgment against the guy claiming that he doesn't know him. So the detective was like, all right, well, can you send that to us? And then when he sent it, the detective's words basically were like, $20 million. And my lawyer was like, yeah, there's a little bit more to this story. So in order for them to not press charges on me, the deal was I have to go talk to them because they wanted to hear my story. And that was, so my lawyer says, you're going to go tell them your story. You're going to, and they're not going to arrest you, but you have to tell them the story. So I show up to this police station and it's like wall to wall in one of the interrogation rooms, but it's like wall to wall detectives and police guys, and they're less listening. And literally I'm just telling them a Cracker Jack version, 45 minutes, hour of my story. And at the end of it, one guy goes, and you didn't kill this guy?
Right. That's why I do that. We're going to say that. Eric, just if you can, just please tell everybody out there listening how they can find your book, how they can follow you, you know, and if anybody wants to, you'll reach out and speak to you. How do they do that?
Well, my book is called 3 Years in Pakistan, the Eric Ide story. Like I said, it took me 9 years basically to get it done. 2 years to write it, 7 years to edit it. I put a lot of work into it. I'm self-publishing it myself, so it's word of mouth. You can find it on Amazon under 3 Years in Pakistan, the Eric Ide story. I spell my name with a K, E-R-I-K, Ide, A-U-D-E. I'm on Instagram. You can find me there. You know, it's my life. You know, if anything, I hope that people will read my story and be able to warn somebody else who might be offered a similar job. You know, if I heard a story like this when I was younger, I think I would have been smart enough to walk away from the job, see it for what it really is. And, you know, I ask people, it's easy to assume the worst about me when you hear it from a different point of view, but I ask people all the time, have you ever helped somebody move, a friend, a girlfriend, a relative? And if so, did you go through all their stuff? And if not, then how do you know you weren't being used to smuggle narcotics? Drug smugglers are shameless. They will hire people like you, me, anyone else, and to get their products across. And
they'll put stuff in baby carriages.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. No, I have. Yeah. There's countless ways for them to do it, and they are shameless. And if there's a way to convince you to do it for them, they will. So my story will hopefully prevent that from happening to somebody else. And I share the story because it needs to be known. The world is a scary place, unfortunately, and there's a lot of bad out there. And the more you know, the better, you know, the more protected you'll be, I feel. So you can get my book on Amazon. I hope you read it. I hope you like it.
Absolutely. And again, it's an inspirational story in many ways as far as, you know, persevering, learning, and getting through it, and still being the man you are today. Again, please come back and talk to us. Once again, if you dream out loud, look out for Eric Ide. Check out his book on Amazon. And we look forward to seeing where this next step goes.
Thank you for listening to Screw the Clout. Join us next week for our next amazing guest.